And the middle of the week, and the radio was chock-a-block with stories, from reaction to the verdict in the George Floyd case, living life with more sustainability, and period poverty. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
The first woman to die in 1916 was a lady called Margaret Cho. And the last person to die was also a woman, yeah, also named Margaret Cho, no relation. And she was written out of history.
I realise now that changes are coming, and there's going to be a tsunami of changes, because, you know, the liability factor for an officer has increased.
Being in a room with other people singing that sound and the impact of that sound beside you, behind you, in front of you, it's really quite uplifting.
And we'll start with this from the Liveline. Period poverty. What's so wrong with giving free tampons and sanitary towels to women who can't afford them? Well, Marion called Jo.
Yeah, Jo, I was just very disappointed the other night looking at Euronews.
Lidl
were having a promotion for young ladies in Ireland to give them free sanitary wear.
Okay.
And I just thought, would they do this promotion in Germany, say, or Poland, or any other country that they trade in? You know, we're not a third world country, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And why would they promote, especially in the Euro news, and all the serious things that's going on, they'd be aware, mm-hmm, saying that they were giving free sanitary towels to Irish young ladies.
Well, Irish women of any age.
It's, yeah,
and you're right,
age,
it is Lidl. It's only, you're right, it's only happening in Lidl, Ireland.
And yes, very annoying and very disappointing.
OK, well, I'll ask you to expand in a sec. But Lidl Ireland is set to become, this is their press statement, is set to become the first major retailer in the world to offer free period products in stores nationwide to women and girls across the country affected by period poverty, in partnership with Homeless Period Ireland and the Simon Communities of Ireland. Now, what you have to do is you download the app, the Lidl app, so that means you need a smartphone. So that's a bit of a, not everyone has a smartphone. Well, you download the app, and then
they're very smart, they're well able to do it.
Okay, and then you present the app in the store, and you every month you get a free box of sanitary pads or tampons. Now, and they're also giving product, making donations to the Simon Community. Now, what is wrong with
it? Well,
I know that. Well, what is wrong with it?
Well, what is wrong with this is if we're doing this in their own in Germany and all the other countries, yeah, well, why single out Ireland and our women? I mean, you had a programme there about women. You know what I mean? We seem to be a downward trough. Irish women are always being downgraded. We're well able to look after our own.
What I heard you saying earlier was that if I'm expanding on, if Lidl have money to give free, obviously it costs them to give free sanitary pads and tampons, you're saying they should use that money to give them away in third world countries.
Oh yeah, well I would, of course. I mean, there's hundreds of women in other countries are really in need.
Okay.
Us Irish ladies and young girls do not need a little to be promoting, especially when you hear it on Euronews, but enough on our own Irish papers and things like that, mm-hmm, really annoys you and shocks you. But when it's all over Europe, they'll think, what are we like?
Well, that's Marion there. Then Anne called. She doesn't agree with Marion.
My reaction is quite the opposite. I think we should be absolutely applauded for what we have done. Mm-hmm. It is an issue. It has been an issue. We have done surveys here. The amount of time young girls have missed from school because they haven't got the product.
Yeah.
The amount of young girls that have been caught shoplifting because they couldn't afford the product. It's an absolute necessity, and wiping it under the carpet and turning around saying it doesn't exist, mm-hmm, has done no favours to these young girls. And I think that we should be applauded, and I think the fact that we're on the world stage is only saying again that Ireland is a very social, compassionate country, mm-hmm, and that we are looking after what is an issue that hasn't been attended to before.
And do you know, do you know who persuaded Lidl to do this in Ireland?
I have no idea. Okay. I really am.
But you're, you, whoever did, you're applauding them.
I'm applauding them. I was a mother of three children, so, you know, three girls.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We all know what it's like. Can you imagine the distress that young girls have when they haven't got these products? And it's, you know, we're only coming out of an age where one could speak about sanitary products to begin with.
But Anne, what about Marion's point, and that is that the money that Lidl are spending on this, now, as it happens, a packet of tampons, you can get two for six, that's what, 36 for £6, €6 in, but €6 is €6, I take your point, in Lidl. But Marion is saying the money that they're spending in Ireland on this, she said, she at one stage calls it a gimmick for free publicity, they should spend in, say, a third world country that might be in greater need, young women.
I'm not getting into the marketing debate, okay? I'm only just delighted that it's happening,
okay.
That it is an issue. People did attempt before, chemists did attempt to put baskets inside the door to provide these products free. It didn't succeed. Mm. So, you know, just on a humanitarian and an Irish level, I think we're way ahead of the pack.
And what about that it's only if you have a smartphone, Anne? Obviously, that'd be younger. Well, lots of people have smartphones, but generally.
Again, not getting into the marketing point, that was some young executive thinking up an idea of this is the way teenagers communicate with each other. Obviously, there can be another way it can be done to facilitate young people who haven't got these devices. I think it was trying to give dignity to the consumer who would be availing of the products.
And then Niamh called.
Well, I just think it's very progressive on Lidl's part. I mean, there's so many young women and older women who need those products. You don't know what their circumstances are, what reason they might actually need to avail of the service. Mm-hmm. So I think, well done, Lidl. And the fact that somebody's embarrassed that other countries are looking at us thinking that we're poor because of this, I just think that's a very antiquated notion, kind of harken back to, oh God, don't do that in case the neighbours think it's the wrong thing, you know. It's, I think, well done, Lidl.
That's Niamh on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the Ryan Tubridy Show, conductor and musician and choir master David Brophy was telling Ryan about his latest music project.
I'm forming a choir of people who work in healthcare settings.
Great.
Various healthcare settings.
Yes.
And there's a number of reasons for the choir. One of the reasons is I've seen the power of singing and what it does to people when they come together and sing. Mm. And I kind of feel, if there's ever a group of people on this island who need something positive after what they've been through, it's possibly these people, healthcare workers, singing in this choir. But there's another reason, and this is kind of a selfish reason as well, personally, for me. I think we've all kind of felt this, that, you know, how do we contextualise what's happened in the pandemic? I mean, I've found myself, and you're probably the same, and most of your listeners probably the same, where, you know, you're at home given out by the fact that I can't visit my mother or my father, or I can't, you know, do all the things that we're all restricted to. And then maybe later on online or on television, I see an ICU unit.
Yeah.
And I see what people have actually been dealing with, and I feel bad.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
For having had an opinion
and kind of gone, you know, like, I feel bad because I'm cheesed off today for whatever the restrictions are about, you know. So I think I'm only, even for myself, only going to be able to kind of process what's happened and put it in some sort of reasonably, you know, sane context.
Yes.
By listening to the stories of those who actually dealt with it, like at the coalface, you know, and that's part of what this choir is about, is for them to tell their story.
Okay, I agree, because it has been an extraordinarily horrible national, international trauma, and we're still in it. So there's no processing to be done necessarily just yet. And that's for all of us. Then go to the people you're talking about, people working in the healthcare settings, at the front, if you like, the front line, hence, type people who had marks on their faces from PPE equipment, who worked god-awful hours, who took that home with them. Then, not only that, they had, of course, go home and get rid of all the gear and wash everything. It goes on and on and on. And these are the conversations, no doubt, you'll be having.
I don't think we know the half of it.
No.
I don't know the half of it.
I agree with you.
And part of it is, part of the choir is about kind of saying, well, like, what has this been like, you know? Yeah. And I mean, I know over the years that you can interview people till the cows come home,
yes,
and talk to them. But there's something about when they sing together that it just, it's almost like it kind of, the singing, the act of singing together in a choir,
yeah,
is like a valve being released. And I just want to kind of get that sense of what are the stories after the valve has been released, because they must be, you know, it's also the fact you perform, I'm a performer, you know, like, but always, all these healthcare workers, no matter what they do, they all perform too, because they all have to go home from their shift, from their job,
and
take a deep breath and then go back in the next day and be up. And I think a lot of the healthcare workers have, you know, I don't know even if they themselves feel like after the, you know, what they've dealt in the past 13 or 14 months, have they even got the chance to kind of sit down themselves and kind of go, what has happened here, you know?
Exactly.
So it's like the reason, we can't obviously form the choir now because we're not allowed to get together and sing. But I also want to chart the journey out of this as well, because we are beginning the journey out of this. And it's to kind of see not only where we've come from, but where can we go as well. And that's what this is all about.
There was a moment in the first, I think, 4 to 6 months of the pandemic when the frontline workers and people in healthcare settings were being lionized and praised, and there was this clapping and food was being delivered to hospitals and so on. And that seemed to kind of peter out a little bit, I think. And it was summed up for me only the other morning when I was going for a walk, and it was at the front of a hospital, and I saw two people in their PPE gear sitting on a hospital wall together, very lonely, exhausted. And the clapping seemed like a distant promise, you know.
It's interesting because, I mean, you bring up a good point, because I think the clapping came from a good place, because I think a lot of people, like, for example, me, all my concerts stopped, all my work stopped. So suddenly I'm doing nothing, or I'm doing very, very, very little. I did some teaching. That was it. And we're seeing there's another group of our, you know, our fellow countrymen and women who are now working harder. Mm. And I'm working a lot less. So a lot of us I felt utterly helpless. So you feel you want to do something. And even if it is to stand out and applaud or whatever the small gesture is, to say, we appreciate what you're doing. So I think it came from a good place. But there's also a point, I think, where a lot of people have felt, I don't know what to do here. Like, I know I wanted to try and get some, I went online and looked at, can I do some voluntary work here? That was very difficult as well. Because people, you can't go anywhere. You're meant to just stay at home, you know. So I think a lot of people have felt helpless.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, though, who are in jobs and who have, like, you know, delivery drivers, people who work in grocery stores and news agents, people who did what we would have, you know, called, you know, run-of-the-mill, day-to-day jobs, you know, they suddenly were the essential workers.
Yes.
And we're going to have, our choir is going to be just healthcare workers, but across the healthcare spectrum. So if you work in housekeeping and you've changed sheets, or if you clean the loos, or you work in maintenance of the building, or that, we're not just looking for doctors.
Or the musical porter.
Or the musical porter. Exactly,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
that these are the people we want in the choir, you know.
And Ryan wondered what exactly happens to people when they sing in a choir.
I don't know. This is the weird
thing. Do
they
tell you afterwards?
This is like, I'm convinced this is like a big bloody iceberg.
Okay.
And I only see the 10% of it.
Yeah.
Because, well, I can tell you what I know. I can tell you that I've seen people in front of me like change, completely change. And particularly, you go back to the High Hope Square,
yeah,
where I had so many homeless people and people affected by homelessness at the High Hope Square, you know, and you see people in front of you. And like, I remember having conversations with people in the choir initially, and they don't make eye contact with you. And you can see they've, you know, these people are, to some degree, they're broken in some way. They've got low self-esteem, and just how they talk to you and the interaction, you know. And I can see after 3 weeks, they open, they slowly open. And the singing does that to you. Yeah. I know people who've sung in choirs that I've directed before who'd say to me, I say something to Maureen beside me in second altos that I would never tell my husband.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that the choir seems to be, I don't know what it is, like what you'd call it, a safe place or something.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
And it's almost like, yeah. Like, I know at the High Hopes Choir in particular, I saw that as kind of a drop-in choir.
Okay.
A lot of choirs are very not that they're competitive or anything, but they kind of, you've got a lot of members in the choir who say, no, we're going to really sing really well, so you've got to come to all the rehearsals. Okay. Whereas High Hopes, I kind of felt, look, if you don't make next week's rehearsal for whatever reason, that's fine. Come in the week after. So
if the High Hopes choir was a drop-in choir, I suspect this one will be the choir of catharsis.
Yes, I think so. Catharsis is a good word, actually.
For people to unpack, to use that expression, yeah. to analyse, process a bit, and among like-minded souls.
Like-minded souls, but also people who have had similar experiences yeah. to them. And I also, one of the things that I think as well, we've heard so many times as well, that people in healthcare settings have used skills that they weren't required to use before COVID. I've heard of stories of people who've been redeployed,
yes.
or people who did some training on the job very quickly to do other tasks that they didn't normally do because of staff issues or whatever, you know. So I think people, they've been through a lot, and I think it's not that the choir becomes a place where everyone's going to be analysed and we all have a good cry sure, together.
Course. And one of David's recruits is Fiona Ash.
So Fiona, you work in the hospital sterile service department at Tata University. So you keep an eye on all the instruments that the surgeons use, among many, many other things. How has your COVID experience been, and I don't mean your personal story, but I mean broadly speaking, as somebody who works in the healthcare world, how would you characterise it all?
I think mainly seeing the effect it had on staff members, you know, the trained staff, you know, the just sheer exhaustion on their faces and the impact it's had on every department, on all staff members across the board. It's not just trained members of staff, doctors and nurses. It's the cleaning departments, the catering, you know, support staff across the hospital. It was, you know, really impacted on them massively. In the change in role in the hospital.
One of the things that was so striking as we reminisce almost at this stage about the early months of COVID was mm-hmm. the fear of the unknown. No one quite yeah. knew who, what, why, where, when any of this was going. And mm-hmm. there you were, you know, at the coalface of it. You probably looked into many people's eyes and saw that fear.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. My own included. Just the unknown of never seeing this before and how does it affect people. It really was quite scary. It really is quite scary, you know.
And you had to, you know, keep an eye on yourself as well, of course. But when did you contract COVID?
In April. I was redeployed to the wards in March from my department. And I think I was there about 3 or 4 weeks before I became ill.
And your husband?
Yes, and one of my sons became sick with COVID as well. I had isolated in City West in the hope to keep it out of the house. But unfortunately, my husband and son started to get symptoms after I had left. So they were here and I was there. And the other three children had to isolate themselves completely. So it was a bit difficult for my husband at the time.
I can only imagine. And did long COVID factor as well?
Yeah, I think it takes a long time. I suppose every person is different how it affected me. I think it was just sheer fatigue going forward. You know, it took a few months for the fatigue to lift. You know, walking up a flight of stairs when before I could run up and down flights of stairs, whereas that kind of took a while to come back for me. My husband didn't really affect him in the long term at all. My son still can't kind of smell or taste food. So, you know, but teenagers tend to swallow the food, they don't chew. They just throw it down their
throat. That's for sure. Good to hear nothing's changed since I was a kid. That's good. And Fiona, what about when you had that exhaustion and you had to overcome COVID experiences? So were you working as well throughout that afterwards?
Yes. So was off for the isolation period, and then when I came home, obviously two people in the house were still sick with COVID, so I isolated for another 2 weeks here at home, and then I went back to my own department in Tally University Hospital. I think kind of late April, early May, I think I returned to work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was every day kind of you'd have a good day, and then a couple of days later you'd be, you know, feeling that exhaustion again, but it did lift. It just took time.
Can you sing?
Yes.
Oh, thank God. After all that. So this is
yeah,
good news.
Took a while, yeah.
And the idea of a choir for David's healthcare workers choir, was this something that piqued your interest pretty quickly?
Oh, very much so, yeah. One of the people that I work with had noticed it on the notice board and, you know, she put me forward for it. So it's a huge privilege to maybe be able to be part of something like that. You know, I seen the other two choirs that David had worked with, and it was really something, like he said earlier, to see that change in people during the process. It really does lift you, and being in a room with other people singing that sound and the impact of that sound beside you, behind you, in front of you, it's really quite uplifting.
Fiona Ash from The Ryan Tubridy Show. Now, the accumulation of stuff. There's something great about saving things from the bin and remaking and reusing, getting the old paintbrushes out and breathing new life into old things, and just living your life with an eye on reducing waste and more sustainability. Elaine Byrne runs livinglightlyireland.com. Emma Gleeson is author of Stuff Happens, and Karen O'Mahony is a sustainable designer. Her business is Rag Order in Dublin, and they joined Claire Byrne in the morning.
Elaine, I'm going to start with you, and we had a chat before. You're very practical when it comes to sustainability, but you absolutely do what you can, and you began all of this yourself in your own house in 2016. You joined a zero waste group and off you went from there, isn't that right?
Yeah, I've been doing it now about 5 years. And so, yeah, I discovered that single-use coffee cups weren't recyclable or biodegradable. And I just thought, well, what else don't I know? And so I started looking into the area and then just trying to do it slowly, testing things as I went. And some of the things I've kept going and some of the things I've stopped doing because they were too much time or they were too expensive. So, and I'm very clear, I report that on the website about what's worked for me, what hasn't, because I think it's important to be honest with people so that they don't feel like they failed if it hasn't worked for them.
And what's the thing that comes to your mind now when you think of the sustainable measures that you tried to take that it didn't work for you?
So I tried washing with soap nuts. They're like a nut that is imported from Indonesia. Washing clothes with it, and also horse chestnuts. That was another thing. I tried washing my hair with bicarbonate of soda and then shampoo bars. And I know they work for some people, and that's great. They just didn't work for me. I tried to make things myself. We do make some things at home, like we make pizza dough ourselves because it's relatively easy. But I was trying to make crackers for the kids' lunch. And, oh, my God, I could do it nonstop 24/7 and I'd still not make enough. So that went by the wayside. So things like that. And it's different for everybody, but I just like to give my experience to people.
And how do your children deal with this? Because, you know, like the rest of us, you might buy them the occasional treat, like a toy from a toy shop. But now you don't do that anymore. Everything is secondhand, is it?
Well, pretty much everything is secondhand. I mean, there's a few things we don't buy secondhand, like we buy new pajamas and underwear and stuff like that. When my kids were younger and we decided what they were getting, it was much easier because we would buy secondhand without... And they wouldn't... It was a toy, they were delighted. Whereas now, my eldest is 13 and my youngest is 11. And they have their own money because they have very generous grandparents. And so they do have more of a say in the things they buy. And so I might chat to them about how much money they could save by buying something secondhand, and they sometimes like that. But I find, particularly with teenagers, they want something that's current and that's new and that you don't necessarily able to get it secondhand. So it's not about being perfect. It's about buying as much as you can secondhand or doing without. And I would be a believer that if you force people to live a certain way, they're going to rebel when they get older. And so I might have a chat with them, but ultimately the decision about what they spend their money on is theirs. And sometimes they buy secondhand and sometimes they don't. But the things that we would buy for them is always secondhand if we can. Mm-hmm. And you can't always.
And Emma Gleeson is author of Stuff Happens, and she was talking about clearing out clutter and keeping it out.
You know, the main message of my book is that we have to break what I call the clutter cycle. You know, all of us, or so many of us, are caught in this cycle where we're doing a clear out every 6 months and then, you know, we're back to square one the next year. And it's because we are not looking at the elephant in the room when we talk about clutter, which is shopping. So the book goes into, you know, the psychology of shopping, why we feel so compelled to accumulate so much stuff, and also the emotional blocks for getting rid of stuff. But I also talk a lot. I mean, Elaine is a huge inspiration of mine. She knows this. She knows as well. You know, responsibly getting rid of things or passing things on when we're not, when we're finished with them, is a huge part of my work too. And, you know, I often think discussions around sustainability are sort of bracketed in terms of like deprivation and what are you doing wrong and kind of guilt and blame and what are you going to give up. And my message, and I think Karen and Elaine's too, is this will only add to your life, living like this. Mm-hmm. You will save, at a very basic level, you will save money. I mean, it's really basic. It's not about saving the polar bears. Your life will be easier. You will have more headspace because you will know where everything in your house is. You won't have to be doing this clear out every year. You will join a wonderful community of really positive people who share their things, and there's just nothing to lose.
Where do you find that community? Direct us.
Well, we all interact with each other on Instagram a lot. You can, there's low, you know, Free Cycle is a wonderful community where you can pass things on that you no longer need for free. I know I don't use this service myself, but Facebook Marketplace is a place where you can meet people. But from my own personal experience, we all met on Instagram. It's a great place to,
Will you tell me about Drawer Lasagna? Because we're just deviating slightly here. Because you're on the decluttering front, right, and keeping everything neat and tidy. And now we're not going to go off and buy all the stuff to clutter up the house again. But you say, in order to keep things neat and tidy, don't make lasagna in the drawer.
Yeah. It's, you know, we the amount of clients I have who have, you know, four dried out prick sticks in different, that's hard to say, in different parts of the house because they didn't know where they were and they just bought new ones.
Guilty.
So, yeah, but everyone is so normal. But if you actually know where everything is and it is visible, the thing I say is, it should be so easy to put things away that you don't even have to think about it. Mm-hmm. And if when you open a drawer, you should see immediately what is in there. So much of us are living with those drawer lasagnas where we just have to wade through them. And it's just exhausting. So, yeah.
I'd love to be able to do that. But, you know, I talk to my children about giving away the toys that they don't look at from one end of the year to the next. And I just, they just won't part with anything. Do you find that with young children, that they're really attached to all their toys?
Yeah, it's a question I get really, really frequently.
Okay, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do.
What do I do about my kids? So, now, I'm not a parent myself, I should say that. But I have nephews and I see how they interact with their toys. What I would say is try and do a toy rotation situation. So put some of them away. I don't know what age your children are, but...
Seven, six and three. It's the girls, actually. The girls. Yeah. I hope they never listen back to this now. They'll tell me off. But it is the girls who will not part with anything.
Yeah, well, try and maybe subtly hide some stuff away from them. You don't have to throw it away. And then when they want new stuff, rotate it. I mean, that's a top tip for your wardrobe as well. It stops you from buying new stuff constantly. Because we do get so bored of seeing the same stuff all the time. And there are loads of studies done that say children actually enjoy their toys less the more they have.
Right, so don't leave them all out there and the big mess that they create as well.
And if there's a birthday and if there's a Christmas, you know, this is a bit controversial. Try and hold some of the presents back and keep them for, you know, a day when a bribery is needed or whatever. Don't be throwing a load of stuff at them because they will just get bored.
Yeah,
of them
that's a great idea. We always got away with that when they were a little bit younger, and now they tend to see things more easily.
Oh, sneaky. And Karen O'Mahony told Claire about her business, Rag Order.
Okay, so Rag Order is currently a one-woman show. I work out of a studio in Drumcondra. It started 3 years ago and I did just basic alterations around my area, just like zips and hems and things like that. And I've evolved now to focus more on upcycling and remaking older garments that often can have a lot of sentimental value for the owner, just to make them more wearable and something new. So
are you taking commissions, are you, from people?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I work by appointment. And generally, it's like it's a mixture of like alterations. And more recently, it's upcycling. It's things that have a sentimental attachment to them. So I did a show. I filmed a show with RTE for the RTE Player last year called From the Same Cloth. And you get a really good idea of the process involved and what I can actually achieve.
So give me a sense then of some of the items with sentimental value that people asked you to convert for them into something they can use now.
Okay, well, generally, like, it could be something for of someone who's passed on. It could be a lot of clothes that are left after someone passes away, but the person isn't ready to actually part with them. So what I can do is, if they give me a certain amount of them, I won't be able to use everything, but if there are certain pieces that have memories attached to them for them, what I'll do is I'll use the fabric and I can turn it into something that they can wear. So, you know, I've made kimonos and I've made bomber jackets out of fabric from clothes left over.
Karen O'Mahony from Today with Claire Byrne. Now, it's one of the things I miss, just killing time by popping into a gallery. Our national galleries are free and they belong to each and every one of us. So on the News at One, Brian Dobson was talking about hundreds of artworks bought for the national collection.
The work of 70 contemporary Irish-based artists has been acquired by two of the country's leading cultural institutions under a €1 million government grant scheme. In all, more than 420 works have been added to the collections of the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin and the Crawford Gallery in Cork. They include painting, sculpture, photographs, film, digital, embroidery and performance art. In a moment, we'll hear from the director of the Crawford. But first, three of the artists who've been selected. Atusapur Husseini, whose work Mirage will be at IMA, Tom Clement, whose painting has been acquired by the Crawford Gallery, and Nigel Rolfe, whose work European Dream will be at IMA. They've been speaking to our arts and media correspondent, Sinead Crowley.
Receiving this degree of appreciation from the institutions such as IMA, it validates all the hard works and years of struggling to sustain myself as a full-time artist. So, and it's all it will have a substantial impact to my future art practice.
It's not just the monetary value, it's probably more so the recognition in my work and the affirmation in it that that's the thing probably that means the most to me. I suppose knowing that the painting is going to live on in a public collection, it's going to be seen by so many more people that would normally see it if it was in a private collection or if it was just in a studio. So it just increases the exposure of it.
It's kind of revolutionary, I think, for institutions like this one, like IMA, to purchase performance. It's never happened to me before, even though I've a lifetime of working and in my dotage now, and I think it's exciting and really positive culturally to support work like this. You know, it's front-facing work in the arts. It's about the audience and being close to an audience, and it, in a way, the audience witnessing what you're making.
Well, let's talk to the director of the Crawford Gallery, Mary McCarthy. Mary, you're very welcome to the programme. 225 works, I believe, heading on their way, if they're not there already, to the Crawford. Quite a job to make this sort of selection. How did you go about it?
Well, it was a real golden opportunity, both for Crawford Art Gallery and the Irish Museum of Modern Art. I suppose, Brian, like many institutions, we're always looking at art. So we really had lists of artists that we were institutionally both willing to bring into the National Collection. And I suppose being part of the National Collection, as we've heard there from the artists, means that the organisations take care of those works. We're kind of guardians of them for the future. So we surveyed lots of artists' practice. We had lots of artists that we were interested in. We also asked our fellow colleagues nationally to suggest artists that we might overlook from various parts of Ireland. And then our curatorial teams, both in Cork and in IMA in Dublin, had a very good collaborative process where we really looked at all the artists' work. And indeed, we engaged directly with the artists too, kind of in discussion with them and their galleries, which works would be appropriate for us to buy now. Because there's such a, you know, for artists, as we've heard there, it's been a difficult time, as it's been for many, but we tried to choose works that were relevant to their practice and relevant to our collections.
At the moment, of course, we can't visit galleries such as your own, but how soon would you hope people might be able to view these works?
Well, we're really hoping that we'll get open in the May wave of openings when it's safe to do so. And we're really excited about that. Both organisations are really ready to open. And some of the works that we've purchased through this fund, which was a really extraordinary fund from the department, will be on show from July, both in Cork and Crawford and in IMA as part of their 30th anniversary. And then they'll be populated throughout our exhibitions in 21 and 22. And indeed, I think what's also another kind of real validation for the works, we've had lots of interest from other institutions to borrow these works already. So it's not just an investment in our two collections, the state collection. Other museums and galleries nationally and internationally will also have the benefit of these works.
Mary McCarthy, director of the Crawford Gallery in Cork, from the News at One with Brian Dobson. And in the morning, we were waking to the news that police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of the murder of George Floyd. Here's Gavin Jennings.
A white former police officer has been found guilty by a jury of the murder of an African-American man in the United States last year. A video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes during his arrest in Minneapolis last May sparked worldwide protests. The 45-year-old was found guilty on three charges: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. Speaking last night, civil rights campaigner Reverend Al Sharpton said the guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin gives civil rights activists an assurance that their actions can yield results.
This is the first time in a long array of fights that we've seen three counts guilty at all three. We don't find pleasure in this. We don't celebrate a man going to jail. We would have rather George be alive.
Amen.
But we celebrate that we, because young people, white and black, some castigated, many that are here tonight, marched and kept marching and kept going. Many of them looked down on, but they kept marching and wouldn't let this die. And this is an assurance to them that if we don't give up, that we can win some rounds. But the war and the fight is not over. Just 2 days from now, we're going to have to deal with the funeral of Dante Wright in this same county, the same area. We still have cases to fight, but this gives us the energy to fight on.
That's campaigner Al Sharpton. George Floyd's brother, Philonise, gave an emotional reaction following the verdict.
I feel relieved today that I finally have the opportunity to, for hopefully getting some sleep. A lot of days that I prayed and I hoped and I was speaking everything into existence, I said I have faith that he will be convicted. Today, you have the cameras all around the world to see and show what happened to my brother. It was a motion picture, the world seeing his life being extinguished. And I could do nothing but watch.
It's George Floyd's brother, Philonise. President Joe Biden phoned George Floyd's family shortly after the verdict to express his support.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
She had a door.
Feeling better now. Nothing. It's going to make it all better, but at least God, now there's some justice. And you know, I think if John is coming, my dad is going to change the world. He's going to start to change it now.
That's right.
Yes.
Amen. Start to change it now.
The President of the United States speaking to George Floyd's family by phone last night. Let's cross live now to the US and speak to Jamila Jefferson-Jones. She's Professor of Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Professor Jefferson-Jones, you're very welcome to Morning Ireland. Thank you for taking our call today.
Thank you for having me, Gavin.
Can I ask you for your reaction to this verdict and your view of the significance of the verdict?
So I'll tell you, I am very hopeful of what this portends, but there's also some caution there. We still have to get through sentencing, but this is a very big day, or has been a very big day yesterday, in that this is the first time that we've seen something like that this happen, where we have what should have been an open and shut case, thanks to Darnella Frazier's video, and we finally have this feeling that the rest of us can take a breath, to take that breath that George Floyd can no longer take, and say the system is working, that when someone uses excessive force, when a police officer uses excessive force, that there will be some sort of consequence. So that's really what's important here. And of course, you add in the racial elements that this was a white police officer and a black man that was killed. And it's just really important to show that the system can work and to give people the comfort that in the future it may work for us.
It's hard to overstate the importance of the video evidence here.
Yes, absolutely. The video evidence is what's able to show the rest of the world what Black America already knew and had already been facing. And it's, of course, helpful that this happened during the pandemic when everyone was home and watching around the world, right, watching TV. But I can't say how important it is that young Darnella Frazier had the courage to challenge the lie that was actually being told by the police department that George Floyd just had a medical incident. No, he was murdered on the street, and that was proven, and her video evidence was so, so important.
Jamila Jefferson-Jones, Professor of Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, speaking with Gavin Jennings from Morning Ireland. Then later, Claire Byrne was talking to Tipperary native and Washington police officer Mark Kerwin, and he was reacting to the verdict.
I think it's just there's a collective exhale all around the country, you know. I'm very happy with the verdict as a member of law enforcement. And I think a lot of my colleagues are also very happy with the verdict.
Police officers have rarely been convicted, though. Isn't that the case if they're charged at all for deaths that happen in custody? So do you see this in your professional capacity as a police officer as a significant moment?
I think this is going to go down in history, Claire. This is a massive moment. 400 years struggle with racial injustice. It's to me like a micro case with macro effects, you know. As far as I'm concerned and those that I know in my department, we felt that when Chauvin did what he did and placed his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, that in actual fact he wasn't wearing the badge. It was an embarrassment to all law enforcement.
Will it be transformative, though, this verdict?
I believe, you know, when you look back at in June 2001, the Department of Justice and Metropolitan Police, who I work for, changed a great deal and were they actually formed the Office of Independent Monitor for an outdoor or an outside agency to come in and look at how use of force was conducted in Metropolitan Police in DC. I think the majority, the issue is that there are 18,000 police agencies at the federal and local level. And it's very hard for the Department of Justice to put into effect a policy that blankets all of these agencies that they would follow.
But the shame around this, Mark, the shame around this for police officers across America must be shared. The standards aren't, but the shame must be. And I just wonder, as you welcome the verdict, do you feel that your colleagues feel the same in the main?
I think the majority do. I think those that that serve the badge with honour, that they certainly do. You know, I think it's very hard to look at it from other countries, specifically in Europe, where, you know, when you join law enforcement, it's a 3-year training college, basically, that you go into, versus the average in the United States is 19 months. So I think that overall, police officers at every level are ashamed and also realize now that changes are coming and there's going to be a tsunami of changes because, you know, the liability factor for an officer has increased.
And can you talk to me more about that, the liability factoring? What concerns might you have around that?
Well, I suppose my concern is that, you know, there are officers who will second guess situations when they're in them now that will put themselves and others at risk because in the back of their mind, everything we do is cognizance. You know, you're trained to do everything from like memory matter. And it's for police officers who are now in extremely dangerous situations, those officers may think twice. And I don't mean about taking someone's life. Nobody wants to take anyone's life. Everyone wants to go home at the end of their shift And those suspects as well, you know, no one wants to take a life. But what I'm saying is that officers may now think twice and put themselves in a more, and suspects in a more serious situation, a life and death situation.
But if people are listening to this, Mark, and they hear about a situation which happened only in the last number of days where a 13-year-old had his hands up when he was shot, people will be saying, well, it'd be no harm if police officers who are carrying these weapons have to think twice.
Oh, no, and I agree with you completely. I'm not saying that... I'm not talking about the everyone should think twice when deadly force is being used or has to be used. But, you know, that's why there's a use of force training within each police department, that, you know, the last thing you want to do is to use deadly force, you know. And I honestly believe that more training and more time in police academies rather than 19 months would benefit both the public and law enforcement.
And then Bashir Atukoya, Assistant Professor in the School of Law and Government at DCU, also reacted to the verdict.
It was a sense of relief, a sense of surprise, of course, but of course there was happiness in the sense that we did receive justice for the Black Lives Movement, for George Floyd. But it is a bittersweet moment, and it's not a sense of a joy that can last for, you know, the centuries or for days. It is a really short moment of celebration, and I think we've seen that because shortly after there was that report of the 16-year-old girl who was killed. And I think bringing it back home, there are lessons to be learned from the... I know we like to think of it as an American issue, but America is just the extreme version of what race relations here in Ireland could be. That's the extreme end, what we've witnessed from George Floyd. And I suppose the importance of the verdict from yesterday is the fact of police accountability, which we haven't seen for such a very long time, in a very long time, if at all. And so for the fact that we have police accountability in America, where the race relations has been ongoing for over 450 years or more, is a good example of what we should do in terms of justice, equality, and our social system here in Ireland, and what not to do in terms of protecting those minorities.
So you're saying that we should look upon this here in Ireland as a cautionary tale?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the importance of deterrence and accountability. It shouldn't be the case that there's a big media, frenzy about this issue. This is a crime that was committed, and it shouldn't come to the attention, the global attention, before we have justice. It should be a crime was committed, and there should be justice. It shouldn't have to be a global fight in terms of Black Lives Matter before we get justice. And I think the lessons to be learned from the American side is that we do need accountability. We need deterrence so that people in general, but most specifically police enforcement, you know, don't feel like they can do whatever they want and get away with it, which in essence was what happened with Chauvin when he knelt on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes.
Is that what you felt, Bashir, as you watched that 9 minutes, 29 seconds of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck? Did you see in that moment that George Floyd felt, as a police officer, because he had the badge, that he could get away with this?
That's it. That is the crux of the situation, where there is a lack of accountability, there's a lack of deterrence. People feel that they can get away with things, and so they can do, especially when they have a uniform on. And when you know, the stats show that you will not be, you will not be punished for this crime, then people feel liberated to do as they please without due regard to somebody's life. You know, this was a clear disregard for life. You know, to be able to do to kneel on somebody's neck for 9 minutes, that is just a clear disregard. And I think the greatest lesson to be learned from that is that for every crime, there must be an equal punishment or equal sanction. And the role of the law isn't to punish the crime. It's to change people's hearts and mind where society has failed to do that. I mean, we've laws on, you know, theft, on murder, and whatever the criminal law books states. And so hate crime should become part of that. It's not. It doesn't mean that everything's going to change and we're going to get rid of racism, but it's a very good start. And I think the start, the verdict goes to exemplify that in terms of what we can do in making a start and changing the justice systems for the protection of ethnic minority groups.
Bashir Atukoya from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, Joe was marking an important upcoming date in the history of the country and a tragedy that happened in Dublin in 1976.
This weekend is the actual 105th anniversary, the calendar, the exact 105th anniversary of the Easter Rising, 24th of April. And the 54 women, 45 were over 16, 9 were under 16. The 54 women who were killed in the Easter Rising not only have never been memorialised, but they've mostly been forgotten. The only place their names are memorialised, the 9 children are in the Children's Park beside St. Audience in Christchurch in Dublin. That's all the 45 children are remembered there. Their names are engraved on individual stones. And the only place the women are remembered is on the wall in Glasnevin, the memorial wall in Glasnevin, which has been defaced so many times at this rate. It's permanently covered, I think, and it looks like it's covered in black plastic for the last year or so, because it was, people would throw paint on it because British soldiers who were killed in 1916 were also on that list. Now, Barry Kelly is on. Barry, good afternoon.
How are you doing, Joe? Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Do you remember where you were on July 24th, 1976?
I remember it as though it was yesterday.
Tell us.
Myself, my buddy Pierre Doyle and Joe Gallagher were milking cows at the back of the Sunshine Home in Leopardstown.
Okay.
That's now, it's now the Laurel Inn. But we were down in the far corner, just there's a shed. Behind the shed is a little wall in Leopardstown, the stands, you know, for the race course.
The race course, yes.
So we were milking the cows anyway, and next of all, we heard a submersible bang, and we thought, Jesus, what's that happening?
Mm-hmm.
So we two of us jumped onto the wall, Pierre and myself, and we were looking to see if the stand had been collapsed or blown up or what, you know, the race course.
Yeah.
So everything seemed to be looking okay. So as per normal, we finished milking the cows by hand back then. Finished anyway, put the milk into the churns, and away we went back to Roachstown Avenue with Joe Gallagher, and there was no radios in the car then. So back to the farm anyway, and put the milk into the fridge. That was the bat of water to keep it cool.
Okay.
So long story short is, we in for the breakfast and turned on the radio, and we discovered what was that happened was that poor chap, Biggs, the British ambassador, he was actually blown up on Murphy's Town Road.
Along with a civil
servant. Along with that poor girl, yes, exactly.
26 years of age, Judith Cook.
Unbelievable.
Now, did you go over to the site of the explosion, Barry, at any stage?
Yes, of course, sir. Because only up the road, so we lived in Sallynogan, but it was only up the road from where we were always up around Leopardstown and Sandy Ford. But there was a big crater there, about 100 foot by 50 foot,
mm-hmm.
in the road. It was there for about 20 years, to be honest. All she done was filled in the gap and put the tarmac out on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was only talking to my buddy Jerry Bulger. He worked next door to Glen Cairn House. He worked in Glen Cairn Racing Stables.
Okay.
And he was telling me not 10 minutes ago that he remembers the same thing. He was in the stables and they were just back from the first ride out. And Seamus McGrath shouted it to everybody. Everybody take cover. It's just somebody throwing stones.
Yeah.
And of course, that was the explosion, and
the aftermath.
I could say that the poor chap who got killed, as I say.
And as I said, caller, it's pursuant to an article in the Irish Times about the underrepresentation of females in Irish public statues, and the air caller pointed out that Judith Cook, who was a civil servant, 26 years of age, who was murdered by the IRA because she was in the car with the British ambassador in Glencairn near Sandyford in Dublin, that she's not remembered. He has a, and in fairness, there is a Ewart Biggs Memorial Prize, but Judith Cook, and somebody said she's the only civil servant to be killed in the Troubles in the course of her work. She was from England, educated at Cambridge, supposed to be very extraordinarily bright. That's why she went to work at the British Embassy in Dublin.
Yeah, remembering Judith Cook, and Shay called Joe about another forgotten woman during the War of Independence.
To me, anyway, it's an incredible story, but we're down here in Ringsend, mm. and Dr. Porigogo wrote a book about the war, the truce, and the last days of the War of Independence.
Okay.
And in it, he documented about a lady called Margaret Keogh.
Okay.
Who was shot the night before the truce in Stella Gardens in Ringsend.
Okay.
She answered a knock on our door. She went out, and there was nobody there. And as she was turning, she was shot. And she was taken to Patrick Dunn's, and she was interviewed and everything, and she told that she heard a knock on the door. She got up, down to the door, and exactly as I said there, what happened. And
but Shay, what year was this? Was this the war, the Civil War, or the War of Independence?
The War of Independence.
Okay.
War of Independence. So she, the truce came the following day. She was shot on the night of the 10th of July.
Uh-huh.
The truce was on the 11th, and she died, unfortunately, on the 12th.
Okay.
And at our funeral, the British soldiers came out of the barracks because the truce was in place.
Uh-huh.
They came out of the barracks in Beggar's Bush and they saluted her. And there was 2,000 at our funeral.
Wow.
And her father put up a 1-foot heading on uh-huh. our grave in Glasnevin. And she was completely written out. Nobody ever heard of her around uh-huh. here or anything like that
okay.
until Pádraig Ógó Rúach. Revealed all.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you call it? We set up a Margaret Keogh committee here in Ringsend.
Okay.
And we got a plaque erected, or sorry, a gravestone erected to her last year by the National Graves Association. And this year we've just got permission from Dublin City Council to erect a plaque on the Dodder Wall.
Okay.
Just opposite our home in Stella Gardens. So, you know, it was just amazing. Like that, she was the first woman to die in 1916 was a lady called Margaret Keogh, the nurse on O'Connell Street. And the last person was a woman. And the last person to die was also a woman, also named Margaret Keogh, no relation. And she was written out of history.
That's Shay on the live line in the afternoon. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Ruth Michelson was talking about the Ever Given, the ship that blocked the Suez Canal a few weeks ago. So where is this ship now?
The ship is currently at anchor in the Great Bitter Lake. And as you say, there's 26 members of the crew, including the captain, that are still on board. And the union, the Indian Seafarers Union that represents them, essentially says that what they want is for that when the contracts of each of those crew members expire, that they can be repatriated home.
Okay, but there is a huge claim against the owners of this ship.
So the ship itself is currently embroiled in this kind of legal battle between the Suez Canal Authority, who've demanded $906 million in compensation from the owners and by extension the insurers of the Ever Given.
Guardian reporter Ruth Michelson from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.